Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how to keep your fingers from freezing up before you perform a sonata.
And how Arizona governors have tried to make state government run more efficiently over the years.
But first, it is officially budget time at the state capitol. The House, which has been going it alone during this process, approved its proposal late Friday. Democrats skipped the vote, and Governor Katie Hobbs has said she would not sign that package of bills. The Senate, which has been negotiating with the governor, is expected to release its plan later today. Leaders hope to approve it by Wednesday. That, though, still leaves the question of how and when the two chambers get on the same page. The fiscal year ends at midnight 2 weeks from today. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. I am anxious to hear your report later on how we make government run more efficiently since we're still here on June 16th.
That is a very, very good point. So, Howie, let's step back into the recent Wayback Machine. Friday night, the House is voting on its budget. Kind of a half-empty chamber, though, it sounds like.
Well, pretty much. The Democrats said, look, we're happy to talk with you. We'd like to be part of it, and you've been left out. So why are we here? You know, they also recognize that it's not like this is the final budget. I mean, there are times that the Democrats have been left out. And so what they'll do is they'll try to amend provisions to say, let's not have the cuts for Medicaid as deep, or let's add some money for housing. At this point, they said, look, the governor has pronounced, as you point out, this budget is DOA. The Senate is off on its own plan, and they've actually been working with the governor and with Democratic senators, and it has about $300 million more in spending. So they say, you know, there's no reason for us to be here at 10 o'clock at night to witness what? A dead budget?
So, Howie, do we have a sense of potential similarities and differences between the House budget and the Senate budget that we're hoping to see a little bit later on today?
I think that there is some belief that you need sufficient cash carry forward. And that's part of what they're looking at is we recognize that there's a good chance of a recession, not this coming fiscal year, but the next fiscal year. And so they're also trying to figure out how much do we need to save. So I think they're both agreeing on that. I think there's some agreement on some of the policy issues in terms of perhaps even some work requirements for public benefits and such. I think there's a belief that you need to have sufficient funding for K-12 and universities. They're also separately working on some extension of Prop 123 and the $350 million that brings in every year from the trust fund. Beyond that, I think we're arguing about projects and priorities. For example, one of the things in the House budget, remember, a budget is more than just numbers, it's policy, would allow people to be locked up to 5 days for involuntary commitment for treatment. That's not in the Senate version of the budget. So those are the kinds of things that I think will be the hang-ups in here. Some of it is numbers, but some of it is what policies do you want to do? For example, you know, we know that last week we were writing about the fact that they were trying to overturn Prop 308 in some form and say, if you're not here legally, you don't get to pay in-state tuition. Will that be in both versions of the budget? I think it's possible, but there may be something where the governor says, I'm not going to sign that, so don't put it in the Senate version.
Right.
And it's all those tiny, tiny little details that are going to keep us here perhaps right up until the end, until somebody finally says, you know, why are we here? Let's just, you know, split the difference, find something we can work with the governor and go home.
Well, Howie, I want to ask you about that, because as we've mentioned, the House passed its budget. The Senate has been working with the governor. Have you heard from lawmakers on either side of the Capitol Plaza that like one chamber is inclined to get on board with the other's plan?
No, because each of them believes that their plan is, you know, the one that handed down from on high. And so what it may take is the Senate President Peterson saying, okay, I'll put the House budget up for a vote in the Senate. and we'll see what happens. My guess is there are not sufficient votes in the Senate for the House budget, although there are a lot of Republicans there who probably like the House budget because it's more conservative. And then if the House budget goes down, he goes back to the House and says, okay, let's talk. Or conversely, you know, House Speaker Steve Montenegro could say, okay, send me your Senate budget, I'll put it up. And then if it doesn't pass, then we're going to have to talk. But I think there needs to be a reality check here that they both need to acknowledge they don't have the votes for each of their own plans. And, you know, it becomes sort of mutually assured destruction. If we don't do something by June 30th, we're in deep kimchi here.
Right. Well, so Howie, you mentioned that the budget is, of course, more than just numbers. There's a lot of policy in there. Does it seem as though and you kind of alluded to this, that there might be some policy areas of policy agreement. Might that be the way that the House and Senate and governor kind of find common ground here?
Well, that's going to be tricky because some of the things in what they call these budget reconciliation bills are things that governors vetoed in the past. Like, for example, you know, having food stamp recertification more often. And so that may be a non-starter for her. I think there are some common ground. Again, I think that the Republicans at least are interested in curbing back in-state tuition for people who are not here legally, despite the fact that voters approved it in 2022. It's crafting something that can come up, as they say, with 16 votes in the Senate, 31 in the House, and the big vote, the governor, because there aren't the votes to override the governor no matter what. So it has to be negotiated. Everybody's going to have to give. The Democrats are going to have to accept some cuts that they don't like. The Republicans are going to have to accept some spending on programs that they don't like. But we're not there yet.
Interesting. Well, hopefully we get there in the next couple of weeks. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Well, it has to be more than hopefully, because come July 1st, there's no authority to keep the government open.
A recently released opinion from the Justice Department suggests that the Trump administration may seek to unilaterally eliminate national monument designations. The administration has previously expressed interest in shrinking or removing protections on protected lands to clear the way for resource extraction or development, and this DOJ opinion would seem to mark an escalation of those priorities. The stakes are particularly high here in Arizona, where we have the second highest number of national monuments in the country. Joining us now to discuss the implications of all this is writer Roger Naylor, the author of, among other things, Arizona National Parks and Monuments, Scenic Wonders and Cultural Treasures of the Grand Canyon State. Roger, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So first, let's talk about exactly what this opinion says. It says that in the opinion of this Justice Department, the president can revoke national monument designations created by previous presidents. That is a reversal of decades of precedent, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously it will be challenged, but yeah, it's opening a door that's never been opened before. So it's very startling. And you're absolutely right that Arizona is especially vulnerable. We have 19 national monuments, so any of them could be at risk.
Now, historically, if I'm not mistaken, Roger, national monuments are popular on both sides of the aisle. This isn't usually a partisan issue, right?
Absolutely. It's one of the few things that we agree on. You know, GQR, a polling company just back in January released a poll that 88% of Arizona voters support the Antiquities Act. And that goes across the political spectrum. 82% of Republicans, 90% of independents, and 91% of Democrats support this. You know, I mean, this is a big part of our identity, these wide open spaces, these protected places. We are the Grand Canyon State. We're the Sonoran Desert and the world's largest contiguous ponderosa pine forest. We're the Superstition Mountains, the White Mountains, Rim Country, Monument Valley, Vermilion Cliffs, and the Sky Islands, and just big, wide open spaces. That's our identity and a quality of life issue for us, as well as a big economic engine.
So you know, not to be too on the nose here, but I referenced the title of your book earlier, where you talked about national park and monuments as cultural treasures. And some folks listening to this may be, you know, more familiar with national parks than monuments. Could you give us an example of a monument in the state that feels like a particularly significant treasure to you?
Well, Canyon de Chelly on the Navajo Nation sort of embodies both of the twin themes of the book, with the scenic wonders because it is absolutely spectacular, and the cultural treasures because it protects hundreds and hundreds of the remains of ancient dwellings dating back centuries that were built by the ancestors of the Hopi, as well as the petroglyph sites and so forth. So, you know, Canyon de Chelly is a national monument. Wapatki, Sunset Crater Volcano, Walnut Canyon, Montezuma Castle. All these are national monuments. Vermilion Cliffs, which includes the Wave, that a lot of people are very familiar with, and the world's largest and deepest slot canyon, Buckskin Gulch, Paria Canyon, all that's in Vermilion Cliffs National Monument. So these are essential places to us, not only for our recreation, not only for tourism, but just protecting wildlife corridors and very often protecting water. Watersheds, keeping our water supply safe as well. So the idea that any of these could be in jeopardy is quite frightening.
Well, let's suppose that the administration does take action here to remove federal protection of some of these lands. Would the state have any recourse in a situation like that?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, that goes beyond my pay grade, but I don't know. I mean, because it's not about about defunding and, you know, stepping up. Most of the work done in these monuments already are done by outside sources. Most of them have friends group that do volunteer work and raise funds to improve, you know, even at the Grand Canyon. That's the case. So it's not just if they're stripping them of protections, I'm not sure, you know, I guess the state could maybe step in and try designating them as state parks, but I don't know what restrictions they would apply either. This seems to be a step towards development of some kind or other, but you know, most of the, you know, there's a lot of things that are still allowed in the national monuments already, in most of them. I mean, this brings together such a wide spectrum of people, hikers and hunters, mountain bikers and off-roaders, birders and backpackers, boaters and RVers. You know, we all come from all these different walks of life to experience these places. You know, we're there for the beauty, we're there for the history, we're there for the relaxation and the quiet, and the idea that we're going to give away to sell off our public lands in some way to a mining companies or timber companies or whatever. You know, this is not the early 19th century when we were, you know, desperate for resources in a growing nation. Right now, our most valuable resources, water, is the thing we need most. And that's so having the parks protect a lot of that is, I think, a good thing.
All right. Well, that is Roger Naylor, the author of, again, among other things, Arizona National Parks and Monuments, Scenic Wonders and Cultural Treasures of the Grand Canyon State. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely a pleasure, as always.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a Northern Arizona Piano Festival includes a masterclass on performance anxiety.
But first, Elon Musk has left the Trump administration and his role with the Department of Government Efficiency to return to the private sector. Musk had originally said Doge, as it's commonly known, would save up to $2 trillion. He later revised that downward, cutting the cost-saving goal in half. Doge's website estimates around $180 billion in savings, although many observers question that number, arguing it's overblown. The idea of making government run more efficiently and inexpensively is not a new one, nor is it unique to the federal government. There have been a handful of efforts on the state level here in Arizona as well. A particularly high-profile one came from Governor Fife Symington in 1991.
So the governor introduced what he called the State Long-Term Improved Management Plan, or Project SLIM.
Doug Cole is now COO of the consulting firm High Ground. He previously served as Symington's deputy chief of staff. He says in the governor's first budget approved by the legislature, Symington got about $2.5 million to start Project Slim. And that, Cole points out, was with Democrats controlling the state Senate. He says the effort was unique in part because it had been about three decades since Arizona had had a governor who hadn't previously served in elected office.
They were part of government. They were part of building government. They believed in government. It's not like Symington did not believe in government. But from a businessman standpoint, he felt that there could be a coordinated effort that you, where you would hire consulting teams from outside of government and then systematically go with these teams in various state agencies, analyze them, interview employees, interview management, and then come back with a plan to make that agency run better.
Cole mentioned bringing in an outside consulting firm. That aspect of Project Slim proved problematic for the Symington administration. Allegations of insider dealing and bid rigging for the firm the state ultimately hired continue to follow the administration through Symington's time in office. That scandal dominated headlines at the time, taking attention away from what Project Slim was actually doing. Cole emphasized the plan was to take a thoughtful approach to seeing how to make state government run more smoothly and efficiently, and in a perfect world, not have residents notice because services would remain the same. A little more than a decade after Project Slim got started, another governor from a different party tried something similar.
So when Janet Napolitano became governor in 2003, in her State of the State, she knew she needed to address how she was going to tackle an over $1 billion budget deficit. One of the things she talked about doing was creating a governor's efficiency review process to improve performance in state government, find savings, etc. So she was hoping to generate savings, but also improve efficiency in government and reduce costs permanently. And it became an ongoing part of the administration, the efficiency review process, the whole time she was in office.
Lisa Glow worked in the Napolitano administration. She's a nonprofit and government consultant and until recently served as CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services, or CAS. The executive order Napolitano signed in 2003, creating the governor's efficiency review, focused on areas like use of the state vehicle fleet, requiring state workers to look for federal money to pay for programs, using email and faxes instead of printing and mailing, and reducing energy costs, among others. Instead of having outside teams go into state agencies as they did during Project Slim, Glow says Napolitano's effort was more internal.
So the approach was all agencies were directed to come up with a plan within the parameters of these specific areas, travel, energy conservation, procurement, areas that you can always find ways to be more efficient, using the in-state training contract as opposed to expensive providers outside. Mm-hmm. So they had to come up with their plans, and then it was tracked, and they had to report on what those savings were on an ongoing basis.
Glow and former Symington staffer Doug Cole both say the efforts of each administration paid off. Cole says Project Slim changed the culture of government.
It was extremely difficult in 1991, 1992 to get it off the ground because Arizona state government had never experienced something like this. And I think now it's ingrained in every state agency and government.
Cole says that's carried through to subsequent governors, including Napolitano's program and later one implemented by Doug Ducey's administration. But longtime lobbyist and Republican political strategist Kevin DeMena says one of the lessons is that it's not that easy to cut state government and that future efforts need to be innovative.
The notion of bringing corporate cost-cutting strategies and tactics to government just didn't happen for a while. May I submit that since government and business are really not that much alike, that it might have been for the better.
DeMena doesn't believe using private sector efficiency strategies in government is a good place to start because of those differences. Napolitano administration alum Lisa Glow says efficiency reviews are good in government, nonprofits, or the private sector. But she says the way they're done matters, both for the results and for the people involved. She says unlike Project Slim or the governor's efficiency review, DOGE seems to be more of a top-down, not agency-driven approach.
The way that it's been carried out, I think, has had some negative downstream impacts that maybe wouldn't have happened if some other guardrails had been put in place.
unlike what has happened here on the federal level since the second Trump administration has come in, the effort here was designed to be a thoughtful process.
Again, Doug Cole.
To go in with teams, with goals, not a dollar goal, but is to look at how they can streamline the operations without affecting the services that need to be delivered at the inside. There was no target number that was identified to save, but recognizing the governor wanted to have a tax cut. And when you had split government, you know, you had to balance that.
What was the end result of Project Slim? I mean, was Arizona government smaller, more efficient, streamlined as a result of this?
Yes. But, you know, you can't score directly in these efforts that this was a result of Project Slim or any other subsequent efforts by other governors, because you have recessions, you have federal government programs that are put onto state governments. So government expands and contracts because of the economy, one, and two, because of what the federal government does.
Those federal government actions are now impacting another Arizona governor, Katie Hobbs, as well as lawmakers, as they work to craft a budget for the upcoming fiscal year and try to determine how much money they actually have to work with and whether they'll need to come up with any cost savings of their own. Kevin DeMena says other trends at the state capitol could pose a challenge to more efforts to make government more efficient.
With the size of the budget, with the turnover in decision makers, and the lack of a transparent and open budget process, the idea of an institutional memory, the idea of having the type of resource that would allow you to go into these budgets and make effective reductions, that information gap may be too big.
We should have a better sense of what any potential budget reductions could look like as lawmakers get closer to the June 30th deadline to approve a new state budget. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Tensions are running high as the conflict between Israel and Iran continues to intensify. Joining us now with the latest, as well as an update on some other key international stories, is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin. Jonathan, where do things stand between Israel and Iran this morning?
Well, we're now into day four of this fresh conflict, and we've had a weekend of strikes and counterstrikes with a major oil depot in Iran among Israel's weekend targets. Most of the missiles fired by Iran at Israel are being intercepted by the country's so-called Iron Dome defense shield, though some are getting through, and at least 24 Israelis have lost their lives so far. Iran had been saying less about casualties on its soil, though its health ministry now says more than 220 people have been killed, and it claims 90% of those deaths are civilians. Now, keep in mind that Israel's actions at the start of hostilities on Friday killed the commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, Hossein Salami, as well as the head of the armed forces, Mohammed Bagheri, and also led to the deaths of several key scientists involved in Iran's nuclear program. The main uranium enrichment site in Iran at Natanz was targeted as well, but it's thought that Iran's stockpile of uranium that could be enriched further to make an atomic bomb lies intact, buried deep in a mountain in Fordo, encased in lots of concrete. President Trump has urged the two sides to make a deal, though Iran says it will not negotiate while under attack. Meanwhile, Israel claims it has full aerial control above Tehran.
So how is all of this likely to play out in the coming days?
Well, this is a major escalation on the part of Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu believes that if Iran successfully makes a nuclear bomb, it would be an existential threat to his country. So he's doing everything in his power to prevent that from happening. But the key question is, what happens next? The issue has shot up the agenda at the G7 meeting currently ongoing in Canada. And really only Donald Trump at that gathering has a great deal of leverage over Israel's prime minister. And there are several scenarios that could make matters quite a bit worse. One is if Iran chooses to start striking US targets in the region, military bases, diplomatic missions, and so on, thereby dragging Washington into the conflict. And military analysts say only the US has the sort of bunker-busting munitions that could destroy that Fordo facility. But if the US were to enter the conflict, that would mark a huge escalation. There have also been reports that Donald Trump vetoed a proposal from Israel to assassinate Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Another possibility is that Israel fails to reach Iran's stockpiles of uranium and simply makes the country all the more determined to develop a nuclear weapon. It could lead to an extended series of strikes and counterstrikes and an accelerated arms race. And then there's the possibility that a global economic shock gets triggered if Iran, say, tries to close the Strait of Hormuz, which carries around a fifth of the world's oil supply daily. The resulting rise in prices could lead to another major inflation shock, which the global economy really does not need right now. So the coming days are absolutely critical.
Let's switch gears here, Jonathan. This week, there's a debate and vote in the UK House of Commons on decriminalizing abortion in England and Wales. What is the background on this?
Well, the first thing to say is that abortion is allowed up to 24 weeks gestation and certain other circumstances under the 1967 Abortion Act. This requires two doctors to sign it off, and even before 24 weeks can require a woman to testify that her mental or physical health is at risk. But outside that framework, abortion is illegal in England and Wales, most often prosecuted under a piece of Victorian legislation, the Offences Against the Person Act of 1861. But this week, an amendment to the Crime and Policing Bill, tabled by Labour Member of Parliament, Tonia Antoniazzi, aims to decriminalise abortion at any stage by a woman acting in relation to her own pregnancy, ending the threat of investigation or imprisonment. The framework by which abortion is accessed would remain the same, but abortions would only need to be signed off by two doctors if the procedure takes place in a hospital or other healthcare setting where time limits would also still apply. Tonia Antoniazzi has said, quote, "The police cannot be trusted with abortion law, nor can the wider criminal justice system."
And how often are abortion cases coming to court at the moment?
Well, in the past 3 years, six women have appeared in court in England charged with ending or attempting to end their own pregnancy outside abortion law. Just last month, Nicola Packer, aged 45, was cleared by a jury of unlawfully administering herself with abortion pills at home during a coronavirus lockdown in 2020. She had taken prescribed abortion medicine when she was around 26 weeks pregnant, beyond the legal limit of 10 weeks for taking such medication at home. She told jurors she didn't realise that she'd been pregnant for more than 10 weeks. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists said that the trial demonstrated just how outdated and harmful current abortion law was and called for reform. That organisation is among several royal medical colleges, charities and trade unions backing the MP's amendment.
All right. Well, finally, Jonathan, here in the US, we have the return of a story from early in the Trump administration, a postponed deadline for the sale of the video sharing platform TikTok is coming back into view later this week. If it is not sold, it could be shut down in America. Where are we with this?
Well, by way of background, last year, a bipartisan law passed by Congress mandated TikTok's Chinese owner ByteDance to sell the app or face a ban in the US. You'll remember the platform went dark for a day in January after the law took effect until Donald Trump intervened and delayed it until initially April the 5th, though that deadline was then extended to this week. The US government's argued that TikTok poses a threat to national security because Chinese authorities might access its vast trove of user data, which Beijing has repeatedly denied. Now, there is, of course, also the possibility that the deadline just gets extended again.
So who might be in the running to take TikTok over ahead of this deadline?
Well, a number of names have been mentioned in recent months. Ahead of the last deadline in April, Amazon was said to have put in a last-minute offer, according to the US network CBS, though at the time, Amazon declined to comment. Donald Trump has said he'd be open to TikTok being sold to the Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison. Another potential buyer is the billionaire Frank McCourt, together with the Canadian businessman Kevin O'Leary, who is obviously one of the celebrity investors on Shark Tank. The co-founder of Reddit, Alexis Ohanian, said in a post on X earlier this year that he'd joined Mr. McCourt's bid. And then the biggest YouTuber in the world, Mr. Beast, has also said he's interested in buying TikTok as part of a group of investors. However things come together, it's a significant moment this week for TikTok and its 170 million US users, who, according to the company, spent an average of 51 minutes per day on the app last year.
Wow. All right. Well, lots to keep an eye on. As always, that is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin keeping us in the loop. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
"2026 is shaping up to be a key year for the Colorado River and the seven basin states that rely on its water. Those states hope to wrap up negotiations on how to use less of the over-allocated river's water by the end of this year. That means Arizona lawmakers and the governor would have next year to approve the deal. Joanna Allhands, digital opinions editor for the Arizona Republic, has written about this, and she joins me along with editorial page editor Elvia Diaz to talk about it. And Joanna, it seems like next year will be a pretty big one in Arizona in terms of hopefully getting the state on board with other basin states. Can you sort of outline what the stakes are for us potentially next year?
Oh, it's going to be huge. And it could really, I mean, I don't mean to make this sound alarmist, but it really could change the trajectory of our state, depending on what happens. And I think that's the challenge, is right now, we don't have a ton of details. We know that just based on some of the proposals that have been made out there so far, that the cuts that could come to Arizona's Colorado River water allocation could be very deep, could be things that could be pretty painful. But how deep, exactly who does that hit, where does it go? We don't have those details yet. And we're really actually running out of time to try to figure a lot of this out. So that's the challenge, is that we know that we're going to have this big thing that we're going to have to deal with. A lot less water is going to be coming our way, but we don't know exactly how much. And there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be saying, you can't take my water. So how do you deal with that? That's going to be the big thing.
Well, and Joanna, as you write, that is, yes, a challenge, but there's also a political challenge coming up in this state as well, right?
Absolutely. Because never mind the fact that next year is an election year. And, you know, I think kind of what's different now based on we've sort of had some of these things come up in the past, not nearly with as high a stakes as what we're facing now, but there have been water deals with the Colorado River that have had to go to the legislature before. What's different is that we've got divided government. You know, there is sort of this tension between the Democratic governor and the Republican run legislature. And water is much more of a partisan issue now than it has been in the past. There's a lot more divisions on Republican versus Democrat lines instead of how it used to be, where you'd get these really weird bedfellows on things, really just depending on the locality and the issue and the water users, not necessarily the politics and the partisanship of it.
So, Elvia, when you look at this issue and this legislature, as Joanna just said, it's become more of a partisan issue as opposed to maybe an urban versus rural issue. How do you see this potentially shaking out in this legislature? Frankly, as Joanna said, with divided government, Republican-led legislature and Democratic governor.
Well, you know what? I see it differently, because I'm questioning, one, why does it take so long to know how much water we're talking about, how deep the cuts that Arizona might be facing. I mean, Joanna was writing about they're going to come up with that with those estimates or those alternatives by the end of this year. And then we're going to have an entire year, meaning 2026, to actually deal with it. For an ordinary reader, listener, that sounds like a lot of time. Not in politics, right? And I'm actually looking forward to seeing this as a campaign issue. I know Joanna doesn't like to see it as a political partisan issue, but I don't think there's no other issue that is more partisan than water allocation, you know, throughout history. So maybe, just maybe, the fact that we're going to be in the middle of a campaign for governor for the state legislature, that the candidates are actually going to be paying attention and actually simplifying the issue for Arizona residents and to understand what really is at stake here.
Elvia, do you see that as a good thing or a bad thing, that, or maybe just a thing, that voters might be a little more engaged on this and candidates and policymakers might be having to talk about this issue a little more on the campaign trail?
I hope so. I mean, Joanna was also mentioning in her column the positive step that Phoenix mayor and the Mesa mayor took in terms of promoting water conservation. I haven't heard that at all. Only in our internal discussions and only on specialty columns like this one. So I'm not sure, again, and I have said this before when we talk about water, that residents really understand or care to understand how our water allocation happens and what dire need we're facing. So anything that we can do to inform residents, anything that we can do to actually get them involved, I think is a good thing.
Joanna, you cite in your column a few recent examples of water policy in the legislature. One that was pretty successful in terms of the drought contingency plan from a few years ago that passed reasonably quickly with reasonable bipartisan support. One that has not been as successful in terms of fighting over groundwater in the state. Which of those do you think might be the better lesson for what things might look like going forward?
Well, I would hope that we look a lot like the drought contingency plan, which occurred in 2019, because to your point, it really was this bipartisan effort. People all got into a room, very disparate water users got together and really were given a lot of leeway to be creative and figure out, okay, how are you going to make this work? It's not necessarily that you're just going to balk. It's going to say, how can you live with this? And I've been saying that for a really long time, is that the only way forward in water is if you not hold out for the deal that you want, but you take the deal that you can live with. That's the only way we move forward, because there are sacrifices that are just gonna have to be made. I'm hoping that we can find compromise like we did during the drought contingency plan. If it plays out like what groundwater negotiations have done so far, that just means no one compromises, everything falls apart, we don't get anywhere. And then that could be really disastrous for us, specifically because Arizona is the only Colorado River Basin state that is required to have legislative approval for whatever deal comes our way. If we can't get through that step, not only are we having issues internally as a state, but the rest of the basin states are going to be looking at Arizona and going, why can't you get this together? Why can't you do that? Of course, that's also presuming that there is a deal that comes, and it's not that everything falls apart and all the states are litigating and going to the Supreme Court trying to figure out how are we going to do this.
Sure. Elvia, does one of those examples strike you as the more likely scenario for what we might see next year?
I don't think we know, and that's the truth. I mean, politicians and bureaucrats move very slowly, as we have seen, especially with water. I mean, if we don't know, and Joanna keeps saying that, if we don't know what kind of allocation we might have, what kind of situation we may face, and we are facing a deadline, and we're still, all that is up in the air, so we can't possibly predict the kind of deal that might come our way or the kind of politics that we'll be facing next year.
Fair enough. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Joanna Allhands is digital opinions editor at the Arizona Republic. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the paper. Thanks to you both, as always. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. This coming weekend marks the kickoff of the 2025 Flagstaff Piano Festival. Pianists of all skill levels will gather for a week of workshops, recitals, and masterclasses, including a session on performance anxiety. Silvan Negruțiu is the festival's artistic director, and he told me that for a true performer, managing your emotions is just as important as mastering your technique.
It's a central part of what we have to cope with as performers. We get shaky hands, perhaps shaky legs. Mm-hmm. There are extreme cases where there is a situation kind of like the mind goes blank. And especially for us as classical pianists, playing from memory on stage, that can create very difficult situations. It's the fear of messing up on stage and being embarrassed in front of an audience.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really important point you're making there, which is that it's not a skill issue. It's not that they don't know the material or aren't prepared. It's something about the idea of performing it, right?
I think, unfortunately, at times, it could be both.
Okay.
And that's why any talk on performance anxiety that I give begins with the emphasis on preparation. Because, of course, if we are not fully prepared for a performance, then we have all the reasons to be anxious about it. But, you know, scientific studies show that at our best on stage as performers, we probably give around 80% of what we can. And therefore, my philosophy is that in order to give that, we really need to be prepared 150% to give our best. And then we begin the conversation about performance anxiety that is not necessarily related to lack of preparation.
Yeah. Well, so let's assume that someone's preparation to the 150% level, as you were putting it, is in place. What are some of the ways that you talk to your students about these other issues that can crop up, even if you've done all your homework? What are some of the reasons you find that these anxiety symptoms manifest themselves?
As pianists especially, we spend many hours every day in a locked room between four walls just with a piano.
Yeah.
And the way we feel in the practice room, in that comfort zone, is very different from the way we feel on stage. And there is a great disconnect there that needs to be mended, so to speak. When we walk on stage, all of a sudden we become hyper aware of every single gesture, of every single note, every finger that we use on every key.
That's very interesting. So you're if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that the key to mitigating performance anxiety is finding a way of having the performance environment as part of your consciousness when you're in the practice room.
Correct. And there are really only two ways to do that. Mm-hmm. Either find a way to feel on stage the way one feels in the practice room,
right,
which is very difficult to do and probably impossible for most, or to bring the level of awareness in the practice room to the one on stage. So, for instance, when I prepare for a performance, I sit at the piano at home or in my studio, and I close my eyes and I imagine that I'm on stage. Another method, given the readily accessible technology in our pockets, that I advise my students to do is to record themselves with video on their phones. It's like here in the studio, once it says on air in red, there is a certain level of, I mean, a little bit of nerves that come with that. And of course, if you probably think back to the first time you were on air, you were probably more nervous than you are now.
Yes.
And that's because you did it so much and so frequently,
right,
that you learn how it goes, what you need to do to prepare for it, and you know what to expect.
Yes.
And it's the same for us, exactly the same. So once, back to the recording, once we press that red button on the phone, there is a certain level of nerves that come with that, that make us focus in a more elevated way than if we don't do that. And another part to it, of course, is to do it as much as possible, mm-hmm. even if it's in front of two friends, family, it doesn't matter, but just to perform in front of someone. As much as possible, and ideally to be ready with a piece so early in advance that one has the chance to perform the same piece many, many times, because with each performance, we learn what we should be nervous about in that piece.
Right. There's the 150% in terms of learning and mastering the music at the level of technique and interpretation.
Correct.
And then there is another layer of preparation in terms of preparing for the circumstance in which you have to deliver that technique and interpretation.
Correct.
So, Sylvain, one of the reasons this is very interesting to me is because at a somewhat deeper level in my mind, and please tell me if you disagree, this also gets at what the intention of learning the music and learning the instrument is in the first place.
Of course. I mean, being a performer implies sharing music with others. There are musicians, they tend to be mostly amateur musicians, who want to master their skills to be able to play for themselves and to just enjoy the process of sitting at the piano or picking up another instrument and playing at home alone. But if we are performing musicians, playing in front of an audience is just, in a way, the ultimate goal.
I would have to imagine that in teaching these classes and workshops with students, you might suddenly find yourself in very emotionally volatile territory.
Yes, it does happen. But I always mention this to my students in one of their first lessons. I will be like your doctor. Nobody else will know all your issues and weaknesses, but I will. And in order to get better at anything, we need to address those head on. The word education comes from educare, which in its original form basically means to draw something out of someone rather than to put something into someone. And every individual has something special about themselves. And I make it my goal as a teacher to draw that special, unique aspect out of each student, because anything that makes us unique is a strength.
Yeah.
And is important to developing their individual voice.
Well, Sylvain Negruțiu is artistic director at Flagstaff Piano Festival and the director of piano studies at the Kitt School of Music at Northern Arizona University. Sylvain, thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure, Sam.
And this is the sound of Sylvain Negruțiu performing Piano Sonata No. 7 in D major by Andrea Lucassini.
Sam, do you try to pretend when you're in another studio that you're in this room? Try to get the same motivation to do your interviews?
Yep. You know, I figure when in doubt, just go live and broadcast whatever I'm saying.
that always works, right?
It doesn't endanger our FCC license,
What
right?
could possibly go wrong with that? All right. That'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.